Hello, and welcome to another episode of the Hospice News Elevate podcast. I'm Holly Vossel, senior reporter for Hospice News and Palliative Care News. In today's episode, we'll be discussing how interest in the hospice space has broadened amid a rising demand, a trend resulting in more transactions and collaborative relationships with other healthcare providers. Before we begin, a quick note. Hospice News is able to produce these podcasts thanks to those in the field lending their voice. Let us know if you or others are interested in sharing your thoughts on an episode. If you'd like to sponsor a podcast, send us a note at editor@hospicenews.com. And with that, we begin our journey into today's topic. All right. So today, our podcast guest is G. Scott Herman, founder and CEO of New Day Healthcare, LLC. Hello, Scott. Thanks so much for joining me today.
Thanks so much for having me. It's a pleasure to speak with you and obviously your listeners.
Yeah. We were hoping that this is a great episode for our Hospice News Elevate podcast. I just want to get started. Why don't you just give us an overview about your organization, New Day Healthcare?
You bet. New Day Healthcare was started in July of 2000 to burn the ships and rethink everything about home case care, including hospice. Originally, we founded New Day to attack Medicare Advantage and better understand what was really needed to manage patients and stop managing payers. Home care, including hospice, does not manage holistically, which is unfortunate and something we're all striving to do. But our seniors have been managed in payer verticals since 1983, when hospice and home health moved to the Part A Trust Fund, and we've managed those verticals via payers. Hospice Medicare patients or hospice Medicaid patients are managed in a payer vertical. If you're a Medicaid patient receiving hospice, you get managed in a Medicaid vertical. If you're a home health patient receiving who's Medicaid payer, you get managed in a home health Medicaid vertical. The reality is these are the same patients. Dual eligibles are the best example. But as an industry, we chose to demand to manage and develop technology by payers and verticals. That development is reimbursement driven, and we've not really made any push to change it. Generally, we still manage patients in those verticals by patient day, episode, the hour, but we really manage care to the incidents and plan for the outcomes for the incidents, not the patient. We're not taking a longitudinal look at patient care to slow the advancement of chronic disease and keep our most fragile at home. We started with the thesis at New Day to develop companies that gave us a measurable mass of patients, build the technology that consolidates all the disparate transaction systems, and formulates data into usable action items. That allows patients to remain in a data-coordinated health delivery system that is home base, which, by the way, we know that's where patients want to be. We identify hospice patients sooner. We see them longer, and as a former hospice nurse, I know the longer a patient is in hospice, the better outcome for the patient and the family. Look, death is a delicate cycle, and it's filled with fragility. The more carefully that is handled, the better the outcome is for everyone. In order to care and identify patients in need of hospice and other services, including palliative care, we developed an overlay technology system called Carelytics. Carelytics currently sits on top of 17 data systems, intakes data from all our EMRs and state-based systems, and we consolidate that. We're agnostic to the data we bring in, so transaction systems don't matter. With this capability, we can run our analytics, our algorithms, and do pattern analysis to identify when patients are about to have issues, and we intervene. Maybe even more powerful, we're able to manage patients that are no longer on our active services, but they're back in community, having been discharged or never admitted because they didn't qualify. But having been assessed through a series of contacts, call centers, text messages, and social media, we're able to identify they're about to have an issue and get them back in. The current demographics of New Day, we're a full home care continuum with an average daily census of about 12,500 patients, and we monitor over 115,000 patients daily. That's over 100,000 patients we're tracking for changes in their conditions that are not on our services. We serve patients in 4 states, Kansas, Missouri, Illinois, and Texas. We do that with 6 service lines: hospice, home health, personal care, consumer-directed, private pay, pediatric, and contract therapy. And we do that from about 30 locations with 7,000 patients crossing service lines each year. We have about 8,000 team members, and we're currently have completed 12 transactions to form the organization. We keep those transactions under local brands in these 4 states, and we hold local markets, so we don't change the name. We keep the local care delivery in place, and we fully integrate the back office compliance function. Our purpose of building this organization is to keep healthcare local, keep people delivering care, that's why they got into this business, and be able to take care of patients through a combination of people, process, and technology in a longitudinal way, across years, not across days or incidents or efforts. So that's New Day in a nutshell.
Well, thank you for sharing that background and that rich history. I think it really kind of leads a little bit into my next question for you is just how you've seen that hospice market take shape in recent years as it's kind of under that wing of New Day's services.
Well, COVID really ignited interest in all home care service lines. Valuations skyrocketed, investors flooded in. Sales processes saw multiple bidders at very, very high valuations. Mm-hmm. In general, home care exploded, but hospice just ignited. Baby boomers, a lot of reasons for that. Baby boomer raising population, driving demand for long-term projections. Some investors made market predictions about hospice and the ability to grow that segment rapidly. People made valuations and interest based on the higher margins in hospice. And quite honestly, it was just simply a frenzy. Mm-hmm. As we started New Day to build what I described, we were founded by operators at New Day, not just investors. We are also investors, but we are as home care operators. And we saw this trend and this frenzy of rising valuations and pricing that was out of market. So we simply refused to get involved in that frenzy. Because I understand if we pay more than a company is worth, that forces the creation of super performance models in order to get these things banked. Without increasing reimbursement, you have to attack cost and efficiency. It's the only place you have. There's only so much room to cut indirect expenses and negotiate contracts. And when those are exhausted, you have to impact care. And that is something we simply were not willing to do. Another factor contributing to the markup frenzy was cheap money through those historically low interest rates. And there was a lot of cheap money out there. That access made the financial models work because the debt service was really low. The only thing that is certain in debt markets is that interest rates vary. And when interest is historically low, coupled with rising inflation, there's only one way to fix it: increase interest rates. Guess what? That's what happened. Mm-hmm. Interest rates more than doubled in a short time. That caused pressure on companies that had taken out a lot of debt, overpaid for companies and assets and hospice companies, and that's leverage. Many providers that paid those high multiples for acquisitions in that frenzy found themselves in very delicate positions with skyrocketing debt service. At the same time, lenders started pulling back, so access to capital became difficult. Now, those financial models were stressed, and the pressure to manage business, secure debt, became really intense. This always happens very rapidly, and it's no different here. We chose to stay out of the situation so we could expand with reason in a very measured and strategic manner. At the end of 23 and 24, we saw the market pull back on pricing, and buyers are no longer forcing valuations up. Buyers have also become disciplined around acquisition opportunities. There's still very strong interest in reviewing, looking at available hospice assets, but we've now returned to sanity when it comes to pricing. Because if you can't create efficiency in those overpriced models, you have to cut patient care. So an unwillingness to do that drove us to this point. Buyers want hospice, and they seem to realize that overpaying in 21 and 22 burned investors, but more importantly, it burned out operators. Also, we think buyers were too aggressive on the organic growth potential of hospice. In 21 and 22, they believed they could rapidly grow census in these hospices. And the reality is this, as a 30-year hospice nurse, I can tell you, these are actually slow growth organizations. Until you reach a significant scale in the top 10% of market share, this is a slow process. That's due to heavy compliance, dependency on strong relationships. In summary, the market stabilized. We see it's adjusted back to a more normalized pricing level. And we firmly believe in the long-term market growth and sustainability of hospice. That's noted by our recent investments. And as we continue to be very involved in hospice acquisitions, we'll watch those market conditions quite closely.
Yeah. And I appreciate you sharing that perspective about how hospice market has been changing. And you mentioned some of the factors driving that interest and some of the potential challenges that might be dampening that interest in hospice. You want to expound upon either side of that spectrum there as far as the factors driving and pulling away the interest in hospice?
You bet. Let me start with driving interest. The most obvious is the long-term outlook of senior populations and increasing awareness for hospice. The awareness around the need for palliative care, although as an industry, we generally struggle with those definitions. But the general consensus is that hospice services need to be introduced to terminally ill patients sooner. That has a positive impact. The ability to run hospices as a single service line operation is also a driving interest. If you can run that with two service lines, say a hospice and a skilled care agency, that drives incremental interest. But the most interest we're seeing in the market right now is in running a full service line diversified platform like New Day. And we find tremendous market interest in our ability to identify patients on service, but even more interest identifying patients that are in community that are no longer on service. Being able to understand when patients are about to have a problem, get them the right services, and we push about 7,000 across a year across our service lines, is a critical element in being able to deliver a home-based continuum model. Dampening the interest, hospices are hard businesses to run, and they're very hard to grow. Obviously, there's heavy regulatory and compliance oversight, but hospices are very sensitive to operating models, and sensitive operating models can cause investors to pause. When working with a hospice or working in hospice, you need to build very strong cultures. Those translate into strong relationships with the community, referral sources, and families. Investors that want to grow hard and fast tend to look past the importance of culture and relationships. I can tell you, they all talk about it. But how do they address it? And we've seen many times when they've overlooked culture, we've seen many of them pay the price by losing caregivers and eventually referral relationships. As a hospice operator, you have to remember that you care for people that are dying. Walking along on life's final journey is an honor that only a few are blessed to have. I often tell those who want to invest in hospice, you really don't know what we do until you've been at a bedside on bended knee when a patient takes their final breath. One will know that hospice is a mission that also happens to be a business when they've lived that.
Yeah, I think that's a profound statement there, just to be able to be at that bedside at someone's final stage. Yes, it's a business, but it's also that person behind that business.
Correct. It is 100% that person.
So I want to kind of circle back to your thoughts there when you were mentioning the frenzy of activity in hospice merger and acquisition activity. It's also been followed by this sort of recent slump as valuations come down and less assets are available on the market. You know, what could change as we're heading into this new year in 2025? What do you think are some of the things that could change in the hospice M&A market?
New Day, we don't really consider hospice to experience a slump. I know that's what it's kind of called in the media and in the market. But we view the 2 years as a needed correction and common sense coming back to the hospice M&A market. For 2025, I think there are two key drivers. More larger providers are starting to spin off and divest hospice operations, mostly by geography. We've experienced some recent success with Intrepid and Good Shepherd, a Good Samaritan carve-outs. We feel like those types of deals will be more important in 25. Valuations continue to decline and stabilize, not so much for elite top-shelf hospice opportunities, but for smaller, medium-sized, family-run businesses. We view, like investment bankers that you've been speaking with, that this will be a solid 2025 transaction year with those smaller companies coming to market and incremental carve-outs in those two key areas.
Well, thank you for sharing that perspective. Just to kind of continue on that trend of some of the trends that are taking place in hospice, you know, we've seen more nonprofit hospices consolidate, form those collaboratives together. Do you think that this is going to be a trend that continues, and maybe why or why not?
Yes, I do think it's a trend that's going to be continuing because competition has strengthened, especially the competition for labor and referrals. Nonprofit organizations, and I've run several nonprofit health system-based hospice providers, they have a different operating model and philosophy. But they also must meet the demands of cost control, and there's only so much room to push DME, pharmacy, and supply costs down as a local provider. Once the cap is reached, the answer becomes scale or regional national size and leveraging those economies of scale. Let me just jump to labor markets for a few thoughts, and I'll come back on the non-labor piece of it. Labor markets are labor markets. We have to be competitive with wages and benefits. This is pretty level and pretty local playing field. There's not much leverage there. Local providers rely on brand, convenience, and flexibility. So wages and benefits are competitive, so you have to be or you just lose out. Back on the non-labor costs and why consolidation will continue is there are advantages to size when negotiating the materials and indirect cost sides of the equation. Size matters to get best pricing in terms, and that's a big reason to consolidate. Consolidation of revenues, of course, you know, regardless of tax status, creates cash flow and time to figure out integrations. So yes, I see consolidation trends continuing, especially where scale is a factor for continued success.
And I think that you mentioned some of the benefits of those arrangements. What about some of the challenges when it comes to actually putting them in motion and joining forces between two organizations? What are some of the challenges that come to mind there?
Well, that is a complex question. And obviously, you're a very skilled interviewer, so it's going to have a couple parts in the answer. Roll-ups or partnerships have the advantage to level scale. Like I said, labor is pretty level, so it's local. The scale through partnerships really benefits the non-labor portion of this product. Getting products, getting things to market, getting your contracts. Consolidation sounds great on the surface, the things we talked about. Consolidation of revenues, market share, elimination of other competition sounds great on the surface. But there are challenges, and the biggest challenge cannot be overlooked, and it often is, and that's the integrating of cultures. When we assess potential acquisitions, our very first and most important look is at culture. If the cultures can't align, and they don't have to be perfect, but they must align. If they do not, we walk away. Integrating operations under the same umbrella is disruptive. I don't care how good you are at it or how many times you've done it. It's disruptive. Turning around or growing a business that is struggling, that's very mechanical. And we have very clear, effective steps to fix those problems. But turning around or growing a business that is floundering with misaligned culture is nearly impossible. For us, at least, we simply choose not to spend the intellectual capital or enterprise energy on those situations. There's a lot to be gained with consolidated partnerships, but culture is ingrained in organizations and very difficult to shift. So we pay attention. The challenge is culture. A lot of the rest of it's pretty mechanical.
And I guess, how do you establish those best practices to approaching navigating these hospice affiliations? You know, what is maybe a good way to ensure that you're, for to your example, that your cultures align and can mesh well and be integrated? Maybe some of the things that you've learned as you integrate your own assets recently, any best practices that you want to share with our listeners?
You bet, you bet. Affiliations, mergers, acquisitions, partnerships, whatever you call them, they're the combining of like businesses to reach a defined goal. Tax status doesn't matter. When discussing this process, it matters when aligning culture. The critical best practice is culture, culture, culture. We dig in, how do we define culture and how do we work at it? We dig into day-to-day messaging, meeting structures, overall messaging, direction, and implied focus on patient care. By implied focus, I mean the messages and decisions made by management to get care to patients. If you miss the care button, all the MBAs on the planet will not be able to run or salvage this business, because life's final journey is a mission, not a spreadsheet. Culture and passion are critical for any alignment of a partnership. The business models speak for themselves, but if the care delivery culture is not in place, all the referrals in the world will not solve the core problem and the partnership will struggle. If you're working with a partner, they need something from you and you need something from them. They need care delivered for patients and you need them to help you work out the business model. If you're not delivering care and they're not helping you, you're really not partners. So it's important to be aligned and have the cultures right. We don't take on relationships for the sake of the relationships, and rarely are they volume driven. It's about culture, the quality of the care we can deliver, and the success we can achieve together. The failure is oftentimes the spreadsheet runs it. Spreadsheet's part of it. Don't get me wrong. I have fiduciary responsibilities also. But the spreadsheet can often run a process, but it can also ruin a process. Be aligned on culture, and partnerships can work, and affiliations.
Yeah, it sounds like there's definitely some processes involved to sort of ensure that, and thank you for sharing them. I want to revisit. We talked about how, you know, hospices are approaching these collaborative partnerships. What about how they've approached those with providers upstream of their services, you know, hospitals, health systems, even primary care providers, you know, people or providers that are outside of that scope of hospices? How have you sort of seen that take shape outside of the hospice space?
You know, maybe we've taken a more simple approach to these upstream partnerships and relationships, but we go meet with the facilities and we collaborate to meet facility needs. For example, take patients that others might struggle to get under care. Maybe the care is too intense. Maybe it requires continuous care. Maybe the payer's not on board, but we deliver care and take care of patients. We have healthy GIP relationships in several inpatient facilities and in multiple states. And our key message is we take care of the patients. Providing care is the best sales tool ever created, and it has no slick handouts or TV commercials. What people see and how you make them feel is the best sales tool ever created. Remember, people don't often remember what you said, but they remember how you made them feel. We care for patients, and that always aligns with partnerships and the partnerships that we have. One of my dearest friends and a professional colleague, whose name many of these listeners may recognize, Danny K. Walker, said to me many years ago, 90% of success is showing up. And I'll tell you, at the age of 80, he still shows up every day as a business leader with New Day. We show up and deliver care. The best method for any partnership or affiliation is to show up and care for the patients. Do what the facility needs as it relates to caring for patients. And then you have a partner with whom you can work out the business details. Nobody wants to work out a solution if the other party can't provide what they need. And they need patients cared for. Take care of patients and work out the business. If you can't take care of patients and they can't help you work out the business, you're not really partners. You're not really in a partnership.
And I wanted to also explore, we talked about the nonprofit side. I want to talk about the sort of private equity and for-profit interest that has risen in hospice space in the last few years. What do you see as sort of the potential benefits and concerns associated with that trend in the industry?
Well, there are concerns and there are a lot of benefits with private investment. The hospice space is very fragmented. Larger, more well-established agencies, they get the press. I get it. Those are the marquee names. But on the ground, the majority of hospice care is being provided by smaller local hospice organizations. Those smaller organizations are caring for their friends, family, and neighbors, not Wall Street. These agencies give excellent care, but they can't scale. They provide hospice care for those people in their neighborhoods and at their church. That's why they started. In the beginning, they never imagined they need to figure out how to negotiate better DME rates, especially because now they have to compete with the company down the street that's a national company who's getting the same stuff at 40% less. Most of these business owners aren't provided to do that. They never thought they'd have to figure out how to develop benefits packages for PRN, hospice, CNAs, and chaplains. But those are the realities of scaled hospice providers moving into your neighborhood. At New Day, when we acquire or merge a local provider, we keep the company doing the things they were built to do, care for patients. We keep the name on the door, the staff in place, and we provide the things local operators never imagined they need to provide. We deliver best-in-market benefits for all the staff, technology to support the office and growth, and that gives them the benefit of scale. Lower medical supply costs, lower medication costs, lower DME costs. Now they're competing with the larger company that's come in the into their area. Better and less expensive benefits for more of their employees, better payer agreements, and less administrative burden make them more competitive. We let local providers deliver care. That's the benefit of private equity or private investment. Properly applied, it's very beneficial for a seller, and that's burning the ships and rethinking the business so that hospice can happen. When thinking about taking on an investment or outright selling a hospice, owners should consider the partner that they're choosing to invite into their community. These are your friends and neighbors that you deliver care to. When you're considering selling, the highest price is not always the best fit. In fact, we're almost never the highest bidder in a process because we're realistic. We do what we say we're going to do. We don't lead owners down this unrealistic path of riches only to disappoint them in 6 months. If that's what you say you can do, we price that accordingly. Private investment with the right partners can stimulate innovation, provide administrative freedom, and create new opportunities. If you're a company that's based on care, which the majority of them are, then providing care is why you exist. There are options in private investments, but be cautious who you select. Remember, hospice is a mission, not a spreadsheet, but balance is very possible. On the concern side, PE taking an ultra-aggressive MA roll-up strategy with hospice, the buy mentality creates debt, creates problems, causes models to have to dive in and ration care. Growth is good, and if done correctly, hospice agencies can grow aggressively, correctly. But if too many platforms just jam stuff together, then the industry's hurt by overextended performance models. So it's important to pick your partner. I've benefited tremendously from private investment. And I've been on the other side too. Know your partner and you can do great things in your area and really extend things for your community.
And thanks for sharing both sides of that. And I wanted to also explain some of the, another trend in hospice that's happening is that some of the larger hospice companies in industry have been purchased by insurance providers, while others have maybe joined forces to form larger organizations. So what is really important for the hospice industry, maybe at large, to kind of understand about what these trends mean and what it means as far as the scope of assets available?
Look, insurance providers purchasing large-scale businesses is not new. It's newer to home care and hospice, but it's about insurance providers acquiring covered lives. That's their market share. Consolidation of market share covered lives has the same strategic considerations as the market consolidations we just talked about. In my view, What that means for an individual provider are two things. If you are acquired as a portion of the insurance roll-up, you now have a new mission. You're going to deliver more care to plan members, and it's likely the percentage of patients that are non-plan members will decrease over time. If you're not part of the roll-up and your competitors are part of that roll-up, you have an opportunity to differentiate yourself as a local care provider. You're still caring for friends and neighbors because 90% of success is showing up, show up, keep showing up, and provide care, and you will discover and carve out a nice niche for yourself. Establish partnerships by providing what referral sources need and work out the business. On the macro trends, these providers have large markets but smaller market shares. So those consolidations have created big markets but still have small market shares. That means the work of hospice is still done by the small local provider. Be that provider and provide care. Look for a partner that can deliver benefits to your organization and change the market. If you're smaller, you got a valuable tool. You have a tool that big providers don't have, and that's flexibility. That means you can innovate, adjust quickly, outrun the bigger organizations, and meet the needs of your referral source. Take the patients that are difficult, make the decisions faster, then work on the business model with your partner. If you're not equipped to do that, get an investment partner who is and will allow you to provide hospice care.
And if you're someone that's, you know, really looking to try to expand or invest or buy in this market, what types of hospice assets do you think are coming to market right now? Maybe who is and is not going to be selling their programs, and what might be driving those strategic decisions?
You know, we're seeing a wide variety of types coming to market, from smaller family-run organizations that won't grow past 30, 40, 58 ADC to large platforms. We're also seeing a growing number of assets being divested from larger national players. Strategic decisions to sell are broad as well. Owners who are ready to retire larger national operations that want to focus their attention on other service lines, and owners that are just struggling to scale. A lot of what we see come to market are owners who built a business to care for people in their community. They've been doing it for 25 years. They don't know how to scale. They didn't know how to move beyond their current scope, and they're just tired. And that's okay. We give them the opportunity to continue to just provide care and stay in the business, or sell us the business and move on. And we're okay with either one of those. But without some structure wrapped around you, without the ability to create scale, you get kind of stuck and you don't really have an exit plan as an owner. We provide those plans, as do others. And then those strategic carve-outs are becoming more and more important as large healthcare organizations, ALF, inpatient units, health systems, are really starting to focus on their core business and have recognized we can't really build these continuums because we don't really have the technology and we don't really have the acumen. So let's focus on our core business. Those are good opportunities for us because in the home care provider space, provision of home health, hospice, and personal care services, as well as pediatrics and therapy, we have the acumen and the technology.
Thank you. And I think one of the questions that has percolated as well as we enter a new year and a new, you know, sort of political outlook here, we have a different presidential administration coming in. And I think a question that's come to mind is really how might the recent election results impact, you know, that hospice market, that merger, acquisition, joint ventures, that activity. Any thoughts on that?
Yeah, if cost effectiveness and efficiency is truly the route this administration will take in the short term, then we're the model for that. There's not more cost-effective or higher quality of care that can be delivered than end-of-life care and hospice, as well as home health. Multiple studies have cited this, and it's just almost indisputable. But if cost efficiency is the result, we're in the right seat. That should spur investment and opportunities for buyers and sellers, coupled with inflation coming down and interest settling, all good signs for M&A. Having said that, there is an issue that Bill Dombey walked through during a recent dinner. As I understood him to say this, Washington is overseen by administrators filling cabinet positions. We see that in the news. But it is really run by millions of people below them. Getting the changes in place to drive and recognize the efficiency is truly a monumental task. There are hundreds of thousands of rules and regulations that restrain those government workers from making it happen. For example, a cabinet leader mandates a rule change. That rule that is being changed has potentially hundreds of guardrail rules implemented over years to ensure compliance. The mandate does not necessarily undo the guardrails. The mandate may not have contemplated, let alone managed, the ancillary impact of one rule change upon another. The people doing the work, the people that actually make this happen, they're in conflict. They follow the mandate and violate the rules, or do they pierce all the guardrails and cause unforeseen consequences and potentially personal backlash? These are government employees that will do what they think is right in this situation. Now, the following are my words, not Bill's, so let's clarify that. The following is what I'm saying. These career employees have seen more than one administration come and go. Human instinct is to do what you think is right for you in your situation. What is the number one rule of consolidation, which you talked about many times, which that is what the administration, the government's going to try to do. The number one rule and understanding is culture. So do the cultures align? In some cases they do, in others they don't. Government's been building rules for over 200 years. Ripping them out is not that simple. Having said that, we remain a very effective and cost-efficient model for healthcare, and applying logic, I'm hopeful that we're viewed favorably with expansion in mind. As it relates to investment, what impacts cost and efficiency driven by the federal government could have on our industry will drive mergers and acquisitions under the current administration.
Interesting. And I think just to wrap us up here today with our final question here is, what's important for hospices to have in mind as they make decisions about their future growth and sustainability approaches?
First, it's important to have a capital structure to respond to market changes, reserves, or access to make fast and rapid decisions when opportunity presents itself. You know, piggybacking onto our comments about efficiency changes and what that could mean to individuals, there could be some rapid, unforeseen changes in the industry that capital could bridge. If you can't access capital alone, find a partner that understands the business, will allow you to provide care, and can rapidly infuse capital to beat the competition to any opportunity. If decisions are made that stress agencies, care still needs to be provided, and there's an opportunity to grow your organization and put that care in different communities. Finding and defining opportunities in a local market is not hard at all. Executing the opportunity is everything. And to beat the competition, you got to be better and you got to be faster. And to do that, quite frankly, you need reserves or you need access to capital reserves. Things to be constantly aware of. Compliance and regulatory environment, it's growing fast. It's growing too fast to get operations in trouble if you don't do it correctly. Always pay attention to compliance and regulatory environment. I've always believed the most dangerous thing in home care and hospice business is rapid uncontrolled growth. So you have to make sure you strategically grow your organization, put your effort in the right places, and spend your capital in the correct places. And then clinical care and relationships. Mark Haney at Homecare 100, when he was the CEO at Addus, was getting ready to take them out public, and he made this statement on a panel. He said every cycle, when the market gets great, people come flowing in, and they're gonna modernize home care, they're gonna modernize hospice, and they're gonna take it to new levels and expand it like it's never been expanded before. And something happens, usually in the economy, and their capital structure slip and they leave. And the people that have been here for the last 20 years figure out a way to make it work. So if I was to say, as a 30-year home health and hospice professional, as a home health and hospice nurse, I would say continue to provide care, show up, keep finding a way. You're going to be successful. You're going to expand your market. Growth comes from the effort you put into it. It's more important now than it ever has been to find a good, solid capital partner So an opportunity presents itself. You can strike, you can take that market and provide your care to the communities you want to be in.
Thank you, Scott, for your time and candor and just walking us through the complexities of the hospice market. It's been a pleasure to have you with us today.
Well, thank you for taking the time. And to your listeners, you're out there doing good work. You're out there doing God's work. And we're behind you. We're nurses and we're clinicians and we're operators at New Day. And we know the struggles and we're trying to help create solutions for you and those you serve. So I hope everyone has a great holiday. And if we can help, let us know.
Well, that wraps up this Elevate podcast episode. This is Holly Vossel, senior reporter for Hospice News, an Aging Media Network news vertical, and WTWH Media Company. Thanks for listening and stay tuned for more episodes. Take care for now.